All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
I'm in the hair salon now, y'all, so.
Oh, that's so good.
Getting it done up. There we go.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode. A very Detroit episode.
Yes.
Of Questlove Supreme. If you're watching our never ending soft launch on YouTube, then you know why this is a very Detroit episode. If you're just listening, I ain't describing nothing to y'all right now. We got Team Supreme in the house. Fontigolo.
What up,
bro?
What up, man?
How's it going?
I've been waiting on this one for a minute, man.
We've been waiting for this one for a minute.
Yeah, man. Little brother, we were honored recently in our city, in Durham, with a proclamation from the mayor. And, you know, so it was, we're celebrating our 20th year as well as hip hop's, you know, 50th year, of course. And, you know, there would be no little brother without the group that we have on today. So
exactly. Exactly.
It's been a dream come true. I've been waiting on this one for a minute.
Sugar Steve, what up, bro?
What up, everybody? How you doing?
What up, though?
Actually, I should say, what up, though, Sugar Steve? How's it going?
Everything's good. A couple of our albums have caught fire on our record label. So, but now I got to spend my whole day shipping fucking records all over the world. So
that's a good problem to have, man. You had a dream of your own label, and it's happening. And, you know, that's amazing. Speaking of albums that have set the world and movements on fire, I will say that the totality, the entire legacy of our guest today just rings strong in not only hip hop culture, but in music and everything from their production to their delivery, to their cadence. To be honest with you, just the love that they have for their city of Detroit, the love that they have for each other, for hip hop culture, for innovation, for like doing something original. I guess you could say that their chemistry is, to me, like the most important element that has kept the legacy of this group alive. It's not about one specific member over another member. It's about just the overall chemistry and the contributions that various members have given this particular organization. And, you know, me, myself, nothing will ever, ever, ever. I don't know. It's like once you get in this industry, you kind of see things different from a production standpoint, from a creative standpoint. Like there's a part of your life where music means something to you before you get in the industry. And then there's a part of your life when once you're in the industry, you see things different. Like you see everyone as a peer. And I don't know when anything that this group has created, I don't know. I hold it like the holy scriptures coming from Moses. I don't know. I can go on with a gazillion descriptions about how important the legacy of this group is, especially on hip hop's 50th anniversary. But, you know, we're going to get to just rap. It was something we haven't done in a long time. Friends of the show, y'all. Welcome Slum Village to Questlove Supreme.
Boom, 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 boom.
I'm sorry, man. That was like a lifetime achievement.
Yeah, thank you.
NAACP Image Awards speech and shit.
I know, right? I should have been to the BET Awards this week. I don't know. Yeah, no, you know, RJ Rice and T3. Thank you, man. Thank you for coming.
What's the word, man? Appreciate you having us.
Thank you. RJ, where are you right now?
In the studio. We finishing up this album.
Okay. So you're still in Detroit right now?
Still in Detroit.
All right. And T3, you the same?
Yeah, I'm in Detroit at the crib, chilling. Just happy to be here, man. And you know, happy to be a part of this wonderful show.
Thank you. Wait, I got to ask y'all. You know, I absolutely, positively never miss an opportunity to talk out how important the city of Detroit was to my creativity. I mean, you know, in addition to just interacting with you guys and, you know, even for Batin, for Dilla, anyone, I mean, even illegit, like whoever has come from the city of Detroit, but a lot of my creativity, like a lot of the music I worked on, I technically did in that city. That's important to me. And, you know, so I feel like I have a relationship with the city as well. That was instrumental, like between 97 and around like 2006. And even like when I tour, like I know places by heart, I go by myself. Detroit's a little bit different now. Like from what I'd known it as 25 years ago, like just as residents of the city, how do you guys feel about what's happening in Detroit? Like, is it progress? Like things are just different now. Like former firehouses are now like 5-star hotels and
we rebuild it. You know, okay. And it's a good look for the city. You know, it was desolate and bleak for so long, you know, that now we finally getting, you know what I'm saying, the downtown back how it's supposed to be. We finally getting the neighborhoods that was run down, you know, they tearing them down and rebuilding. So, you know, it's good for the city, you know what I'm saying? And I'm happy to see it, you know what I'm saying? Make me want to stay in Detroit, you know what I'm saying? Not ready to get up out of here and go somewhere else.
Right.
So the temptation has never been strong to be like, all right, well, let's relocate to Atlanta or like go down south or anything?
Nah. Not for me.
No. Not for us, because you know what? It's just the vibe. You know, we like, and you could be to yourself. You could be bothered or not bothered. It's a choice you make. And I think that's something we like. You know us, we kind of stick to ourselves. So, yeah, Detroit is a plus for that. You know what I'm saying?
You know, oftentimes, like, all right, take a city, a musical city like Austin. Austin takes a pride in its weirdness. For me, though, like the Black version of what I see Austin in terms of, I've just never seen a city so open. And once I realized that, you know, you guys were raised on the Electrifying Mojo. And if, you know, you guys listening, go on YouTube and just start listening to Electrifying Mojo, you got to realize that this dude was basically one of the last of the Mohicans in terms of there was a time when radio really trusted its DJs to do whatever they wanted to do. You know, now, like, you kind of are, you're a prisoner of corporate radio, in which the playlists are like predetermined before you even, you know, like, September's playlist has already been determined for you. So whereas a guy like Electrifying Mojo back in the early 80s was like just playing some of the weirdest music ever. And so, you know, once his listeners are growing up and immersed in this music, it's like no wonder Detroit is such a creative hub where people just think different. Is that weirdness still prevalent in Detroit right now as we speak, or
I think it's still happening. I think a lot of the people that are the younger people that are kind of weird, they came up on us. I get a lot of that from the people like Curtis Roach and a couple of other cats from Detroit. But then right. You know, Detroit has a whole nother side, which is this hood. you know, from these creative people to just hood. You know what I'm saying? And right. then you got the creative hood, which is kind of a merge of both, which is like Soda Baby, you know what I'm saying? Stuff like that. So
see, that's the thing. I even though I think you guys in the very beginning might have been slightly defensive towards how we saw y'all, because you know, like the music was one way, but you guys were saying some like crazy outlandish shit on top of it. Like
right. Y'all
are just as hood and creative, but I don't know. The first time I came from Detroit, I'm like, yo, this is like a city that will listen to Thomas Dolby and do the Carlton, but they're also going to beat your ass if you fuck with them. Like, and that's the shit I couldn't get.
Right. Yeah, you know I mean, because you know, we've always been a collective. We grew up on Tribe and NWA at the same time. It wasn't either or. It wasn't rock, jazz. It was any music that we can find creatively. We there. And then we grew up on techno, which is totally something else, you know, in itself.
I think that's key. I think you guys embracing electronic music and techno is the key to why Detroit's so crazy.
Yes. Yes. Creatively. Yes.
See, you had it at one point where they would play all the hood stuff during the day. You know what I'm saying? The commercial stuff. Then at nighttime, when people going to the clubs, was like all techno, you know what I'm saying? Stuff like that. So our prime time getting ready for the party was techno music. So, you know, we had the opportunity to have that balance, you know what I'm saying? Like T was saying.
Can you take us back to the beginning to where, like, if I'm looking, I guess in archaeology terms, like if I'm looking for the spark, the sticks and stones that like built a spark, where does the story of Slum Village begin?
I would say it began in Persian High School, where we were, you know what I'm saying, a school, you know, Persian High School, which is this, because when I was coming up to be a rapper, you know, it was weird. That was considered weird to be a rapper. You know what I'm saying? Because it's just so like, even though it was a few rappers, hood rappers that was out there, but what we was on, we was extra L-O-N-S, extra, you know what I'm saying? So we walking around, you know, extra clothes, extra, you know, dreadlocks, you know, we out there, you know,
like, right.
Early, you know what I'm saying? So when I heard about other guys that were like me, I was like, oh, okay, now we got a squad. You know what I'm saying? So now that, you know, I ran into Dilla because I heard about him through this guy, through that guy, heard about Baitan and then Wajid and everything, and it just all clicked up. So it was
so like, it wasn't a neighborhood thing. Like they weren't your next door neighbors. Like you heard about them from the other side of town or.
I mean, we in the same neighborhood, believe it or not, but I did not know them.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Which is like, cause, I mean, in Detroit, you're not going to come outside your house and just walk around and, you know what I'm saying? So you going to your house, you know what I'm saying? To your destination and back because you don't want no static. You don't want nothing to happen. So you just going to where you going. So even though we close and we all in Coney Gardens, it was just like different random parts. Like,
right.
And I had them if it went for school, you know?
So RJ.
Yo.
Actually, our listeners out there should know that, I mean, you come from a lineage of, you know, Detroit hip hop, being as though, you know, your father is, you know, the legendary RJ of RJ's Latest Arrival. Like I grew up listening to Shackles.
Heaven in Your Arms is the one for me. That's the one. Like,
yeah, exactly.
On my rotation right now, still on my Spotify.
Yeah. So can you talk about just growing up as sort of like lineage of Detroit culture? Like, what is your childhood like with your parents that are popping? Like, you know, I have them on Soul Train. I have them on, you know what I mean? Like they were national. They were always played on radio. So what was it like just growing up in that environment?
I grew up on the road. So between them touring and stuff, you know, like I was like out on the Fresh Fest and, you know, stuff like that with them as a kid with Fat Boys and Run DMC and all of that. So that's kind of how I grew up.
So were there Jermaine sightings as well? Because I thought Jermaine was the only kid that was like allowed in the Fresh Fest. Did you get to see him at all? Like,
nah, because remember, I'm 10 years younger than T.
So
I was like two.
Okay.
Three years old. So
Jermaine Dupri was like 11, 12. Okay. Yeah. I get it.
Yeah. So between that and then, you know, when they would be on the road, when I got to a certain age, I would be with my grandmother. And my grandmother stayed in Coney Gardens because that's where my father grew up at. Gotcha. So that's how all of everybody kind of came together.
Can y'all describe Coney Gardens? Like I know it as a song, but what is the neighborhood of Coney Gardens?
It's a hood, but it's not like You know what I'm saying? It still got good people. It still had a good batch of people there. It wasn't overly violent, but it did have its hood aspects. You know what I'm saying? We always had a nice park. I lived right across the street of a nice park. We had a nice, you know, place to play and whatever. So, I mean, you know, I don't know why, you know, we had so much respect for. And it's the only neighborhood really in the hood where you see where they got the actual banner where it says Coney Gardens, like they named this hood. You know what I'm saying? They really don't do that. It usually be like East West, that, you know, whatever the name of the street is, but they actually named the whole neighborhood. So once we saw that, you know, we just gravitated to it because, you know, we had found each other in, you know, in this awkward little place.
As late children of the 70s and 80s, just in your general childhood, how aware of you guys of the lineage of Detroit? Like, was living in Detroit just like to you growing up in the early 80s, like, ah, man, this town used to have something and then everyone left it, like there's no more music left? Like, was there still a strong presence of the music lineage that the world knows as like Detroit?
I definitely say, yeah, man, I grew up on the Motown sound. It was definitely part of my household, part of everybody. Everybody was still very proud of that. Even though Motown had left and went to Cali, you know what I'm saying? We were still very proud of that. We still had the Motown Museum. We still had, you know, we were still proud of all the musicians that came through. So that was a definite, just soul music in general. We all grew up on that. That was definitely part of our, you know, our bringing up, you know what I would say.
Yeah. I want to ask y'all, man, specifically, when you were talking about techno earlier, New Dance Show and the Scene, break that down. Like, what did that mean to Detroit culture?
That was everything. Everybody used to run in the house and tune in our version of Soul Train. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. When you see dancers who became popular in the neighborhood for showing up. And also, it broke a lot of rappers, too. A lot of up-and-coming rappers, they got a chance to perform on that. So the New Dance Show was everything for us. My wife worked at the museum now for the New Dance Show. So wow. It's still a part of my life today. You know what I mean? Yeah, man, it definitely inspired us in many ways.
I will say that the Scene, you know, to our listeners out there, if you've not watched it, just to describe it, like most territories, parts of the United States would have their local dance show. Detroit had the Scene. I know Chicago had a show that was more geared to stepping. Okay. Philadelphia, we had our show called Dancing on Air, which found some success and actually became national, known as Dance Party USA. And right. That's where like Kelly Ripa used to dance on the show, whatever. But
oh, wow.
Yeah, a lot of localized, back when dances were regional, you know, how they dance in Detroit is not how they were dancing in Texas. And, you know, you would only know when you would like visit cousins in the summertime, like what kind of dance is that or whatever. So like for Detroit and dancing, do you guys know the history of the Earl Flynn? Like, what is it about is the Earl Flynn still a Detroit move, or is that just like one specific generation? Even your history with dancing, like I know in Baten's version of Pregnant on the first Slum Village album, it's an interlude where he's rhyming over the Roger loop.
Right.
You know, it's only like 45 seconds, but he literally, I read the lyrics and basically he's saying that I came to a jit, like I came to a party to show them how I dance. And they looking at me like I'm a weirdo and, you know.
The jit is a Detroit dance, kind of like okay. Chicago got footwork. You
right.
know what I'm saying? Detroit has its own version, you know what I'm saying? A little more technical than the footwork. And that's what he was talking about. He said, when I walk in there doing my jit, they looking at me crazy. You know what I'm saying? Because he jitting and he got dreadlocks. You know what I'm saying? So jitting was like a cultural thing here. You know what I'm saying? Like everybody jitted for the most part. So right. That's kind of how it worked. The Earl Flynn was like, if I ain't mistaken, T, that wasn't that like the gang, Earl Flynn?
Gang called the Earl Flynns. And that was their move that they used to do to let
That's where it came from?
Yes, that's where it came from. It was a gang.
So answer me this. around the Parade album period, you know, I would routinely, like, Prince's relationship with Detroit is just on some other level. Even when I would go back to old album credits, at least like from Controversy, 1999, Purple Rain, whatever. I mean, I didn't even realize that Prince's love for Detroit, like, all of his Detroit shout outs start with "What up, though?" You know, and I'm like, Prince knows this speak? Like, what does Prince know? And if you watch like concerts in 86, assuming that this is the Earl Flynn, like where you wave your arms back and forth, Prince was routinely, so that was Prince's version of doing,
I guess,
a seed walk or whatever.
Yes.
Do brothers feel a certain way like that, or like?
No, they have overwhelming love for him. See, you got to think, like you said, go back to the Mojo. Mojo broke Prince. He would play a whole Prince album on the air. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes even with the curse words.
And yeah, I was like, how does that happen?
And Prince used to call him. He would pick up the phone and call him and thank him. So they developed a relationship. You know what I'm saying? And they became really close. So he helped Prince break in Detroit, man. So, you know, they became great friends, man. You know, so it's just a dope that Prince incorporated so much Detroit in there. Yeah, it was incredible. Yeah.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonsigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
When the Roots first visited, Detroit was the second American city that we visited when we first started touring. And the place that they took us was a spot called the Hip Hop Shop.
Okay.
Which, I mean, by that point, Maurice Malone, you know, hip hop fashions were starting in 94, 95, starting to become a little national. It wasn't just localized, but was the Hip Hop Shop sort of just like a localized hub for an MC back in the early 90s, or like, how, talk to me about the relationship of that establishment.
Well, we had a few establishments, but that was one of the main ones. And that was the one that really, you know, had the breakout artists. You know what I'm saying? That's where Royce and Eminem and D12 and L and just everybody was at this spot. So this was the spot for MCs. You go there, it was only on Saturdays. They sold clothes during the week. Maurice made his own clothes and sold them. And then he let us have an open mic on Saturdays. It was hosted by Proof, Recipes to Big Proof. And yeah, you know what I'm saying? We had some of the illest battles. Now, in Slum Village, we didn't really battle, but we used to like premiere songs and play certain joints and do stuff like that. But it was some dope battles there. You know, M had a few battles there, a bunch of people. So it was our spot. It was our only spot, really, at that time. We had a couple of nighttime spots, but that was the time. And it was in 7 Mile, which is kind of scary. If 7 Mile, it's like a Martin Luther King Boulevard, you know, type of
thing. All right.
But at that time, it was all love. You know what I'm saying? Everybody went there, did their thing. You had some guys smoking weed in the car. You had some people drinking their little beers and then going there and do their hip hop. You know what I'm saying? And then it was just a dope spot for us to do it. So shout out to Maurice Malone for doing that, man, setting that up.
In your opinion, like how is hip hop translated in terms of like, okay, so a song like Ain't No Future in Your Front, and like, was that just universally accepted by the entire hip hop community? Or did, you know, was it like, okay, well, you guys are more West Coast sounding, so, you know, that's y'all's thing, and we're more East Coast sounding, so this is our thing?
No, like, it was universal, because we Detroit is like the melting pot of every sound. We listen to Luke and Two Live Crew on the radio. We listen to Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg. We listen to Tribe, Twista. They play everything in Detroit. So it was just like a dope song. Detroit just accepted it as a dope song. It wasn't about, it sounded more Cali. It was just, you know what I'm saying, represented the city as a whole.
Speak on the first moment in which it's like, okay, let's start a group. Now, I know before it was Slum Village, the name was
Cinnapot.
Yeah, Cinnapot. Yeah.
All right, Cinnapot.
Dopeness backwards.
Okay. Yep. Oh, okay. So explain to me how, like, the year that starts and the group in that formation.
In that formation, it started off, like I said, I heard about these cats. Number one, we was dancing to everybody. Speaking of dancing, everybody in my crew danced too, by the way. You had to dance.
I can attest to this. Yes.
You know what I'm saying? So everybody in the crew danced. But anyway, I had heard about some cats. I heard about Dilla and this. And I heard about Baten. But first, it was like me and Baten. And I got with Baten and YG first. And we had a group called Hard to Oppose, which only did two songs. But yeah, it was more West Coast gangster sound in a little bit. But yeah, we had those couple of songs. We did that. And then we heard about Dilla and about the beats, and then YG introduced me to that. Then we decided to do official Cinnapod stuff, which means we went to the studio, Moe's studio, this hood studio, and we recorded these couple of records. And one of the records had a Flip Wilson sample in it. So it was very zany.
Oh, wow.
It was that very elegant. That is what you heard from Cinnapod. So the Cinnapod lineup was me, YG, Baten, Dilla, QD.
Oh, wow. And,
QD was in this?
Yeah, QD was in this, because that's when Dancers was really a part of it. And QD started off dancing first, so he was a part of it.
So you're saying at this point, L.O.N.S. was kind of y'all North Star?
Yeah, North Star. Between them and Organized Fusion.
Okay.
Early, yes, but definitely L.O.N.S. for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. So we made our couple of first records, which was called Rat-a-tat-tat, The Sound of the Whack. And you know, we all doing the chants, and you get a, you know, all that, because everybody was doing that at that time. Right. And we did a couple of records at Cinnapod, only that. Before we formed Slum Village, sure.
There are records?
I said only two records, literally two.
No. I mean, like physical, like I can find this on eBay records?
Ooh, no, not physical records. No.
Okay, y'all just made some songs. I was about to say, man. Okay.
Yeah, no physical records.
Not exclusive. Back then, like, what was the process of making music? Like, who was, because you're naming a lot of MCs and a lot of beat makers. So, like, what was the division of labor, at least for that particular project, like?
I think YG produced one and Dilla produced one. QD only did backgrounds, and me by 10, Dilla rapped. And okay. Featured this one guy, this guy who turned out to be an R&B singer. I forget his name. Yeah, but yeah.
Dwelly? I was like, who?
Right.
No, I mean, he underground. He didn't blow up big, but he.
Okay. I see. And that configuration lasted for how long? And then how did it morph into the second phase of the group, which I guess is Slum Village?
It maybe lasts for a few months, before everybody decided at that time that, you know, dancing was kind of been getting played out a little bit. So maybe a year, maybe dancing was getting played out a bit. So we didn't really need to dance no more. And YG was like, Dilla's beats is incredible. I don't need to be doing no beats no more. And then it was like, well, we the only people left. So it was basically then. So we was in the basement one day. And
did you know it was like when you're hearing this stuff? And I've heard even in the what we call the camp amp era, shout out to Amp Fiddler.
Yeah.
Camp amp era of Dilla's musical development. Were you guys at all aware, like, all right, this is a weird ass shit? Like, I live in a territory, and still to this day, I know that a part of my production has to appease the need to please the barbershop in Tariq's head, you know, whereas like sometimes I want to do some crazy off kilter shit, but then I'll give it to Tariq. Like, he ain't going to fuck with this because it's just too weird sounding. But it's almost like all those, I think the earliest song I heard from you guys is, was it Here Come the Drums or Bring the Drums or.
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yes. About the drums.
Right. Which is crazy shit. You know what I mean? Even the early demos of the songs that wound up on Fantastic were just super weird. Like, how is there no filter for, especially coming from Detroit, which I imagine you have to have a protective shell of hardness to get respect. You guys were just like, anything goes, and if it's weird, it's dope. Like,
yes, this is true. I mean, I think, like I say, most of our albums were based on comedy. So just us making each other laugh is what we was really doing. So we had dads, so we would, you know, when we was working our little factory jobs together, we basically laughing all day, creating ideas, using that for songs, just, you know, so it just basically came out of humor. And it was enough of us where we felt like we could just stay in our bubble and never be a part of the real world almost. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So we were just in our bubble, just period.
So there was no, like, when you play it for your boys and there's no cringing, like, that's a demo or fast forward, like.
Nope, all my boys was just as weird. So it was just like, we was all found each other. It was a good 100 of us eventually, but it, you know what I'm saying? But the core was like a good 10. So yeah, we was all just as weird. And they was like, the weirder the better. Oh man, that's, you know what I'm saying? Because to us, hip hop was all new. We didn't kind of grow up on no structure like, you know, New York did when hip hop was a certain type of way. And you know what I'm saying? It was just whatever high creative you can get. You know what I'm saying? And that's kind of what we incorporated.
For people that's so immersed in pop culture, how are you getting this stuff where, at least for my first 15 years of coming to Detroit, there really wasn't nothing. Like, I knew you guys, so you guys were entertainment enough. But for the average person, like, what was there for culture?
Well, the culture is, we're building this thing up, you know what I'm saying? from stone by stone. So you saying, okay, when Slum Village started coming up, we started building up our audience where we had a literal following of people. At least we can get 100 people to come to our show. You know what I'm saying? And that's why when you hear the Look of Love and you hear the audience.
The Look of Love, I was going to ask, yeah.
You hear the audience singing it. That's just fans before we even got on. You know what I'm saying? Because we had already built up a base piece by piece. You know what I'm saying? And as far as the movie theater, it was one theater in the hood that you could go to called the Bel Air. You
know what I'm saying? Yeah, no, I didn't go there. I know about the Bel Air. It was told.
Nice theater. I used to have to catch a bus to get to it, but yeah, it's a nice theater though. But yeah, that's the spot. And I knew you was a movie man because, you know, we went to the movies one time. We was on the road together somewhere.
That's my thing. I was like, yeah. Damn, nothing. What do y'all do up here? So, all right. So the thing is that when Fantastic is finally coming to fruition, so what's the discussion in terms of, like, we got to make our own tape? And I heard there was a rumor that you guys were initially about to sign to Ruben Rodriguez's Pendulum label.
Yeah, that was a possibility, but that was later though, a little bit later down. But yeah, that was
earlier before.
Because I think Pendulum came out in like 92, correct?
Yeah, Pendulum is before Volume Fantastic Volume 1. That was with Pops and Sally.
That was true. Okay, yeah, that's what happened. Well, we were signed to John Sally and his dad. They had a place called Hoop Studio.
Okay.
Basically they were gonna sign us. It was between us and Diggable Planets.
Oh wow. And,
oh wow. See.
And
y'all almost
yeah.
This explains it. The thing is that you guys sound like, when I heard Fantastic, we were more amazed that like this doesn't feel like a demo. It sounds like this group has had experience before and y'all sounded like professional. Now Fantastic winds up in my hands in like 96, 97. So even by 92, you guys were at least set or poised to make your grand arrival or whatever. So
yeah.
Now that makes sense. Do you think you guys were ready for that back then, or
no?
Are you glad how it turned out?
Yes, absolutely. Because if we would have came out, we had this song called "Is It the Magic," and it had the upright bass, and it was everything you wanted—a jazz / poetry rap. It could be. It was all that. You know what I'm saying? And Ann Filler was on there playing it. Shout out to Ann Filler, always showing us love. Yeah, so that was that record. No, I don't think we was ready because we were still developing styles, and I just think we weren't ready at that time. What you think, Jay?
Hey, man.
All things in due time.
Yeah, that's what I say. I think it worked out exactly how it was supposed to.
I was recently doing this radio show about the Milestone Records label and McCoy Tyner specifically. And the guy who owned that label, Orrin Keep News, said something to the effect of when he first met McCoy, you know, McCoy was like, you know, you gave me this one session and then you never called me again until later on. And he said, well, back then you weren't McCoy yet. You weren't McCoy Tyner yet, meaning, you know, he hadn't developed his unique style or et cetera, he found his voice. So when y'all were starting out this time period that we're talking about, was Dilla Dilla yet is what I'm asking. Like his earliest beats, had he found what we now know as what he did? Quest could probably answer this question too.
I think as a listener, there were already signs of what was coming in the future. So sort of like, and you know, I've gotten my hands on a lot of these like 92 beats, 93 beats. Yeah, even for back then, that was some really unorthodox thinking that, you know, I was like, wow, even early, like I'm pressed to find something that I'm like, that's not really whack. Like you see that he was searching for it. Of course, he perfects it, but I don't know. That's to me, like coming out the gate, it was an immediately like a jarring thing of like, this isn't like how the hip hop I grew up sounding is made. So, but it didn't sound like an amateur making it. It sounded like someone doing it on purpose.
Right. But you all recognized at that, even early on, that he was a special talent.
Yes. When I heard Dilla's beats, I was like, this is it. This is it. Early. Wow. First of all, you think it's just you and your neighborhood, like, oh, he's just good for your neighborhood. But then you start branching off, you're like, wait a minute, this guy is really incredible.
Yeah, he's right everywhere.
And like, you know, like I said, he started off with just the pause and cassette, took that, was then went to this and went to that, learned on. It was like, man, I was amazed. I was just happy to be along for the ride for the most part before we even got a chance to develop what Slum Village would come to be. I was just looking at him like, how's this kid? He my age. Well, how's he doing? You know what I'm saying? I'm looking right. We the same age. You know what I'm saying? And he was just killing it. You know what I'm saying?
What year were you born, RJ? Like, how 80. Old were you at the time when this is happening?
92. I'm about 8-9 years old.
Okay. So when you're first hearing this, does it hit you different? I think as an adult, it hits me different simply because, you know, I knew what the lay of the land was. For me, the lay of the land was like what Tribe was doing and what De La was doing and what Public Enemy was doing, what Marley Marl was doing. And so Dilla's arrival is more akin to that of like Godzilla coming to town. Like, wait, what the hell is that over there? You know, that sort of thing. But for you to come, you know, to be much younger, it's not like you had an established lay of the land of what once was like, oh, black and white television. And suddenly, like in The Wizard of Oz, everything turns to color. So for you, though, like, how are you receiving this at a young age?
I knew it was dope because he was producing for my kids group. So he was doing some of our demos.
Oh, wow.
Wait, really?
For sure.
Tell me about this. I didn't know this.
I had a group called, first it went from Spoiled Rich Kids, Kid You Not, you know what I'm saying?
And, kids always in it.
And he was producing the demos for us because of the studio. We was all signed. So my pops had us signed. He had Slum signed. He had Paul Rosenberg, Eminem's manager, was signed right to the label. And
he was rhyming?
Yes. Yeah, he was rhyming.
I need evidence.
He was dope. He was dope.
He was dope too.
Paul Bunyan. What? Yes. And Skinny Supreme.
Did you know this, Fonte?
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm Skinny Supreme.
It's in Dan's book. He talks about it a little bit.
Yeah.
No, I just never heard of the music. That's all.
And I never heard the music, but I've heard the story.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was all of us up there.
And this Barack Recordings?
Nah, this is Hoop Sounds. This is in 92 when he opened the studio with Sally. We would go up there and I would see him. You know, I come home from school and seeing Dilla make beats in my kitchen. You know what I'm saying? So it was just like, oh, okay, this is like a big brother, and I'm seeing him, you know what I'm saying, record, and then he was making demos for us. So right. I always knew, you know what I'm saying, he was dope.
So who's teaching you how to make beats at this time? Like, how old were you when you started messing around on machines? And what technology was at the studio?
I started making beats the first time I was on a DMX drum machine, just programming in the drum machine. Okay. And I was just picking up Pop's equipment. When I actually started producing was around the age of 13, 14.
Uh-huh.
And just being at the studio, I was like, man, I might as well give it a shot. So I asked my Pops and he was like, man, I'm not teaching you nothing. You know what I'm saying? Get the machine, figure it out if you want to do it. So I sat there and figured it out. Eventually, the guys come to the studio. He like, play them some beats. This is around like 97.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? And 98. And I played them and they laughed at the beats. Dilla Bati and the T was just fell out laughing. And, you know, they like these beats funny as hell. So after they leave out, you know what I'm saying? Dilla like, yo, man, let me show you some stuff. So he showed me, you know what I'm saying, how to work the 3000.
Okay.
So I'm like, okay. So he like, work on that. And when I come back, I'm going to show you some more stuff. I want to hear what you're doing. So he would come back in, check up. Like, what you got? Okay, this is how you work the effects in the 3000 to get delays and stuff. And then eventually, you know what I'm saying, Corrupt came to Detroit, and I ended up producing some songs for Corrupt.
How old were you at the time?
15.
Wow.
Oh, okay.
So when Dilla heard the beats that I did for Corrupt, he was like, okay, now you ready. And then that's when, you know, I kind of got in the mix with that and then producing on Climax with Dilla.
Right.
And mixing the record and all of that stuff. That's how I ended up at the video shoot with y'all.
Ah, nice. Nice. Damn, so you were literally young RJ.
For sure.
Yes.
Literally. So can you tell me how and the whole process of making Fantastic One? Because for me, the bomb that Dilla dropped on me was that he made the music for Fantastic Volume 1 after the vocals were done. He was like, he would just do a hi-hat, tss, tss, and you guys would just rhyme to the hi-hat.
I would say this. Number one, it is what happened, though. Volume one got done because a dumb beef. It was the group Fire Ella. Shout out to them. And Dilla
the same had, Fire Ella that's on All of Y'all's on a Day. Yeah, yeah.
Same Fire Ella.
Wait, are y'all singing? Wait, is this 5-4-3-2-1 LL thing again? Are y'all like beefing with each other on the song?
Yes, yes.
Wait. I was only playing. Are you serious?
First of all, every song on Volume One is me either talking about Dilla, Dilla talk about me, or him talking about Bati.
I didn't even ask that question. Wait, I'm talking about other crews.
Yeah,
you guys are just basically using the microphone as a pulpit bully like method.
Yes, yes, yes. We enjoy.
You gotta give me specifics, because
when Dilla say I'm sick of niggas popping up in my crib, but he's talking about
unannounced shit.
He's talking about me because this nigga, he told me, he said he'll tell you to come to his crib and then he won't answer the door, and then he'll say I'm popping up. I'm popping up at the crib. You told me to come. I done walked over here.
You know, I never knew this shit.
Stuff like that, man. Us tons of stuff like that. Yes.
And so, what, counterfeit niggas be running? It's
Yeah. I'm coming back. Yes, that's all we did all day was talk about each other. On the first whole volume one.
You were lightly ranking on each other.
Yeah. I mean, you know, because that's kind of niggas we was.
I don't know why the fuck I'm fucking with you. Right. All this.
Well, that was a chick that Dilla was messing with. That's that. It went. I ain't talking about it. But then by 10 threw a couple of slick lines in there too, though. So yeah. All day, all we used to do. But like I said, it started off with a beef with them, and Dilla had produced a whole tape. Now, mind you, Slum Village didn't came out with official nothing yet, and they was bragging like, "Oh, Dilla did our stuff before he did y'all." Boom. So here come YG hyping us up. The first song we going to do is Players. Talking about them. That's the first song we did. Mm. Players. We was talking about them and this other guy from the old hip-hop scene that I was talking about personally, because we was dating the same girl and he got mad. And I tried. Well, anyway, but yeah, it's something like that. So that's how it all kind of started, you know, after that.
What is the 788?
788 is our birthdays. So Dilla's February 7th. I'm November 8th, and by 10 is March 8th. So it's just our birthdays. And,
you guys are weird. All right. So
so I was inspired by that. So we did like half of the tape to just clicks, and then half we did beats. So I went off. But then even with the beats that we did, he still remixed.
Yeah, he would change them.
But it wasn't. Same either. So that's how we did volume one. And we did it, like I said, we did it in a week. Because we had all these rhymes that and songs, you know what I'm saying? Just from 10 years of being together, we was together for a long time before we actually came kind of out. You know what I'm saying? So
what did y'all record volume one on? Because it sounds like y'all just recording on like headphone mic. Like all what kind of equipment was y'all using?
we record part of it on headphone mics. Because we had two mics, and then we had to do part of it straight to that. So it's stuff straight to that. That means one takes. That means if you fuck up, we had to start all over again, do it again, because we're doing straight to that. Then we took part over to RJ's studio once we got some time to do that. So it's all over the place. With the
it's going to have to roll. Fuck that.
Yeah. That's why I had to roll, because we did it like 27 times. Like, oh, fuck that. Nigga. Yeah, I mean, but I enjoyed the process. And when we made it, if you listen to me at the end, I'd be like, ooh, I already knew.
Right.
I already knew at the end of one of those songs. I already knew it was going to be a classic. Yo, I was like, ooh, this is it.
So question. All right. I always wanted to know this. And I know I'm like asking you to remember like inside jokes from like almost 30 years ago. But so on Fat Cat song. Or at least at the end of How We Bullshit. After listening to this song for like 25 years, I listened to Fantastic like its entirety last night for the first time in like maybe like Maybe for like 5 years. Like it's been a minute since I just sat down and listened to any album in its entirety. But it finally hit me. Am I correct in assuming that you guys, at the time that you recorded it, the Soul Train Awards must have just came on because you're obviously talking about Escape, like at the very beginning. Like you guys are trying to remember their name. You're like, you know, the group that sings, get back your seat, relax it. Right. But then there's a moment where I believe that you guys are mocking Color Me Bad's first single of their sophomore album, Time and Change.
Yeah. Yeah. That is true. That's true. Because everything was comedy. That is true.
All right. Do you remember the second album that Color Me Bad did, Fonte, where?
Yeah, Time and Chance. Yeah.
Yeah, where they decided to enlist Bootsy and the P-Funk All-Stars as their band.
Oh, I missed that part.
Like, it was really weird. Like, anywhere they were going, like literally, like I'm looking at Gary Mudbone Walker and Bootsy Collins and Catfish, wow. But just be side guys to Color Me Bad, not like, hey, like at least in Delight, like Delight was like, yo, y'all, we got Bootsy's Rubber Band as our band. But literally, I saw a performance on the Soul Train Awards. Finally, I looked it up and I believe that that's what you guys were mocking because, like, at no point, dude. Did you guys think that that was ever going to get out or get back to them or anything like that?
So I think we thought we was being so coded that people was going to really be like, ah, oh, you know what I'm saying?
You know, it what took I'm me saying? A minute.
as possible. He's trying to be coded. And that was shout out to Frank Nate. That was Frank Nate that was saying that too. That was Frank Nate.
For real. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, everything was based on jokes, comedy. I don't know why we decided to say that before the song that we was getting ready to record. I had no clue, but we just kept it. Like, oh, okay.
What was your level of shock that not only is this going to take off in your city, but at what point do you realize that this cassette demo might actually be not only hip-hop's most important creative shift? Very quietly, though. I mean, not like in terms of Dr. Dre, like turning the whole world around with the sound of the West Coast, the G-Funk sound. But at what point do you realize that this thing is going to be bigger than just something local or something that's dope for hip hop, but almost like damn near its own genre or a way of life? Like, at what point does that hit you?
Believe it or not, it's once we got that demo or that volume one to Q-Tip's hands.
Right.
And he started calling this person and people like you and then people like D'Angelo and all of these people saying, oh man, that's when I'm looking like, okay, these are people that I admire. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And I love their music. And that's when you know, okay, we do got some legs. You know what I'm saying? We got something to stand on. But you know how long that takes because it's word of mouth. First of all, you had to mail the tape. Remember you had to...
Yes.
You know, and send it to somebody. Okay, now you got to wait. Then they got to listen to it. Then they got to play with their boy. Y'all ain't in the same state. But Q-Tip single-handedly played it for everybody. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, he did. I can attest that the first time I heard Fantastic Volume 1... I was in Germany and living off of per diem and weekly stipend. So, you know, like, you know, to be a broke starving musician living on about $375 a week on your own to fend for yourself, and the temptation, you know, to pick up the phone to call the United States long distance for 25 minutes.
Right.
No, literally, like I told them, like set up a microphone to the speakerphone. I want to hear this whole entire thing. That was a $168 phone call that I could not afford. And no, seriously, I was like, okay, I can live off of palm frites. There's a joke in the Roots community, Pomfrites Buku Tamat. Usually after midnight, when bodegas or like those like late night spots that are about to close, right before they close, they might like sell the food for cheap. So when you're touring Europe, you know, you'll go to the kebab dude and he'll cut off half the price. So I was like negotiating my meals. Like I can live off of street kebabs, buku tamats, and pomfrites. And at the venue, I knew I was good for a turkey sandwich. Like, you know, they give you food at the venue. So nah, man, I had to starve 1 week for some slum village over the telephone. But
oh man, sorry to hear that. Thanks.
But on the other side of things, so is it jarring to be in this bubble that's so influential, in which on one hand people are embracing you, but on the other hand, it's almost like we get to sample and taste the nectar of the fruit before you yourself get to enjoy that?
Well, it's a lot. It was a lot for us. Number one, out the gate, we got kicked in the rump because Q-Tip decided when we did finally get him on the record that he wants to use our record as a platform to leave hip hop.
Right. When I heard that verse, I was like, wait a minute.
Right. So guess what New York said to Slum Village? Boo! You got rid of Tribe Called Quest. I like, no, I didn't. I just wanted a verse.
Right, right.
You know what I'm saying? I just wanted a verse. I didn't know when I went down there, he was talking. I was walking with Q-Tip down the street. We was going to Sbarro's Pizza. And we was going to some studio or something after that. And he was like, man, you know, I'm really thinking about quitting, man. I'm out. And then he loops up the original Hold Tight.
Right.
And he starts spitting these sentimental lyrics.
It's something about this group that makes people want to, you know, some sort of catharsis release that happens that makes everybody confrontational on a Slum Village cassette. Yeah, it's weird. So right now, this is 25 years of a legacy. Of this brand way of this brand name, a way of life, amazing, influential music that I deem very refreshing. Can you guys tell me, especially in hip hop's 50th year, how is hip hop still refreshing to you?
Yeah. Right now, Slum Village is at a space where we just creating whatever we feel. That's not in the market. I can do me, like to the total. So because the label situation ain't there no more, you don't have to, nobody saying, hey, make sure you do a hit single or you know what I'm saying? Make sure it is. Nobody knows where's nobody coming. It's wild, wild west. Everybody out there with their pistols and they like.
And anything can hit. Anything can hit. It don't matter what it is. It's just, if you can deliver it to the audience and present it in a compelling way, it don't matter if it's trap shit, boom bap shit, whatever.
I love it. I love that. Wild West. Yes, I'm out there with my pistols. I'm ready to go. So right now, I'm having the best time of my life making music right now. Slum Village is
just living in your heart. I mean, it's like the beginning. Like what you feel that's dope and incredible for you in your heart, that's what you're giving to the world.
Okay, QLS listeners, this is Sugar Steve. That's where we're going to stop part one of this two-part interview with Slum Village. Check back next week or on your podcast feed for part two of this Questlove Supreme conversation with T3 and Young RJ. In part two, they discuss Slum Village's evolution through the years, new music, and more. See you there.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.